explained, and in time had come up with a method of heating the raw, untreated hardwood planks that brought out the natural sugars in the wood. Sort of like caramelizing, Augustine said. We cook the wood, you could say. Done correctly, the process brought out a whole palette of natural hues and shades within the wood itself. Using a variety of woods and varying the heat and cooking time with each, they had developed an amazing array of natural colors. So where do those incredible colors come from? Said Augustine. From inside the wood itself. They were there all the time. He cocked his head in the direction of Annie's station. Something like Annie. People have all sorts of amazing qualities and natural abilities trapped inside them. With the wood, it's knowing how to apply heat. With people, it's applying your belief. He looked at Ben. The other day, you described us as one of the city's great success stories. That's the key to our success right there. Strategies and plans, projections and roadmaps, they don't make things move. They don't make things happen. If you're going to get anything done, you have to engage people. He placed his hand on his chest and patted his heart a few times. And that starts here. Ben nodded as he saw his moment. Preliminaries were over. It was time to engage. To take charge. Well, that segues pretty well into the reason I'm here. Is it okay if we talk about the current situation for a moment? Of course, said Augustine. Ben ran his hand along the smooth plank, just as Augustine had done, marveling at the colors. It would be obvious to any observer, he said, that your people are doing an incredible job. But it's also obvious that they're fighting an uphill battle. Honestly, I think a yes vote Monday would open up a whole new chapter for Alan and Augustine. And he proceeded to lay out his case for the merger. Augustine listened, nodding, and didn't say a word until Ben was finished. Then he nodded one more time, slowly, and put his hand on Ben's shoulder. When we started, there were just the two of us, Alan and me, and a few friends, working out of that abandoned church. You saw our first chair upstairs? Ben nodded. Did you know that was made out of wood from one of the church's front pews? Those first few dozen chairs we made by pulling apart our own office. He chuckled, shaking his head. And then the fire finished the job for us. Amazing. He stood up and pressed the elevator's down button. Ben had the sense their tour was over. As I said, Augustine continued, we were just a handful back then. And today we're 500 people. 500. I've never fired a single employee. The terms layoff and cutback are not in our vocabulary, and we're not about to start now. I like you, Ben, but I'm not naive. If you guys buy us, you and I both know what happens next. I lose half my people like so many spare parts, maybe more than half, and I'm not going to stand by and let that happen. Ben started to protest, but Augustine held up his hand to stop him. Look, you've got your job to do, and I respect that. I have mine. And my job? He nodded toward the halls and airy open office spaces of the sixth floor, where dozens of Alan and Augustine employees sat talking on phones to users of their fine chairs all over the country. Is their jobs.
Chapter 6. The Language of Strength. When Ben was directed by Sal the maitre d' toward what he now thought of as their table, he saw that, sure enough, both women were already there. Ben was a royal of conflicting thoughts and emotions. On the one hand, he was very curious to learn more about Aunt Elle's history and business experience. Had she made millions in the stock market? Been a super successful real estate speculator? At the same time, he was also struggling to sort through everything Augustine had said during their visit. And he was stinging from what felt like a total failure to advance the cause of his yes vote next Monday. And so he did not notice at all when, as he strode across the room to join Claire and Aunt Elle, a stocky man at a nearby table suddenly pushed back his chair to get up from his seat, coffee in hand, and slid directly into Ben's path. The two men collided perfectly, as if they had rehearsed it, sending the husky fellow back down into his seat and his coffee spilling out across the tablecloth. and down his jacket sleeve.
"Hey," the big man barked as he lunged back to his feet. "Why don't you watch where you're going?"
"Me?" Ben blurted out. "I was just minding my own..." But the big man went off on him, berating him for his clumsiness and demanding loudly to speak with the manager about his ruined suit. Ben felt blood rush to his face and was gearing up to defend himself when suddenly, "Excuse me." The tirade abruptly stopped, and Ben was startled to see Aunt Elle standing directly in front of the man, extending a moistened cloth napkin. How on earth had she gotten there so quickly?
"I'm so sorry," she said quietly. "This may be entirely my fault. I believe I distracted him. May I offer to pay for your dry cleaning?"
The big man worked his jaw once or twice, like a fish flopping about on dry land. Finally, he took the proffered napkin and began wiping his sleeve.
"Nah," he managed. It's not actually that bad."
It was true. Only a small bit of the coffee had actually gotten onto the sleeve, and it would easily come out with one good cleaning. The man left the restaurant, after apologizing gruffly to Ben and, less gruffly, to Aunt Elle. And Ben accompanied Aunt Elle back to the table where Claire awaited them with an amused look.
"Thank you," he said to Aunt Elle once they were seated. "You saved my rear end. I thought he was about to knock me back into last week."
"He reacted," said Aunt Elle. "I responded. There's a world of difference."
"I'll say," agreed Claire.
"Nothing ruins a good negotiation," Aunt Elle continued, settling herself into her seat and smoothing her napkin over her lap, "like one of the participants reacting. If more people responded instead of reacting, the world would be..." Aunt Elle suddenly became aware that Ben was sitting still, studying her.
"Yes," she said.
Ben stifled a smile.
"You yielded."
"I beg your pardon," said Aunt Elle.
"You said, the more you yield, the more power you have. That's how you stopped that guy from ranting at me. You yielded."
Aunt Elle looked at Ben for a moment, then turned to Claire.
"You see, he does listen, at least every so often. It's a promising trait."
Ben felt a bit of heat flushing his cheeks, and then caught the slight crinkling at the corners of Aunt Elle's eyes and mouth. He sighed.
"I'm reacting."
Claire burst out laughing. Aunt Elle inclined her head an inch in his direction.
"I was having you on," she said with a demure look. "Yanking your chain, as I believe you kids say these days.
But you do, you know," she added. "Listen, I mean."
"Thank you," he replied. "And you lie."
Claire nearly choked on her salad.
"I beg your pardon," said Aunt Elle again. "Well," said Ben, "you told that guy that you believed you distracted me. You didn't distract me, and you knew it."
"Oh, that." Aunt Elle waved one hand vaguely.
"Well, I could have. Anyway, you know what Aristotle said. It is the mark of an educated mind to rest satisfied with the degree of precision which the nature of the subject admits, and not to seek exactness where only an approximation is possible."
"Of course," said Ben, with as straight a face as he could manage. "I was just saying exactly that to my wife the other day."
Aunt Elle arched one eyebrow.
Just then the waiter came to take their order. It was the same young man who had cleaned up the spilled coffee and dealt with the irate customer. When Ben apologized, he politely brushed it off. Niente. But it was plain to see that he was stressed. The place was packed today.
"Speaking of exactness, I've been thinking about what you said," Ben commented. "And I'm having a hard time seeing how it would actually apply. I mean, in real life. It seems to me, yielding means giving up any advantage you might have. Giving in, saying, I give up, you win, without even a fight."
Aunt Elle thought for a moment.
"May I ask," she said, "how did your meeting go today?"
Ben sighed. "Not that well. I got a tour, met a lot of people, gave it my best shot, and got shot down."
Aunt Elle nodded. "When you go into these meetings, do you ever think of it as engaging the enemy, suiting up to go into battle like knights of old?"
Ben had to admit this was exactly how he thought of it.
"Here," said Aunt Elle, and she held up one hand in front of her, palm toward Ben. "Put up your hand."
Ben did as he was told, and Aunt El pressed her hand against his. She was surprisingly strong, and it took some effort to resist her push.
"There," said Aunt El, as she put her hand down again.
"Okay," Ben waited for an explanation.
"When I pushed," she said, "why did you push back?"
Ben was startled to realize that he didn't really have an answer to that.
"I don't know. I just did."
"And how did our hands move together?"
"Move together? They didn't budge."
Aunt El nodded. "Exactly. Would you call that a successful negotiation?"
Ben frowned.
"So what are you saying would be the right way to go? When the other guy pushes, just give up?"
Aunt El pursed her lips. "Yielding is giving, but not giving up. Two very different things. I'll give you an example.
Abraham Lincoln was once told by a reporter that another government official had sharply criticized him. What did the president have to say about that?"
"I have great respect for the man," replied Lincoln, "and if he has concerns about me, there must be some truth to it."
The criticism was intended to draw Lincoln into a skirmish that would have distracted him from other business. Instead, his comment not only deflected their critique, but also won the hearts of both friends and foes, and allowed the president to keep his focus on the more important issues at hand.
"Lincoln's maneuver," concluded Aunt El, "was what a boxer calls a parry."
"A boxer," repeated Ben, trying unsuccessfully to imagine Aunt El ringside at a boxing match.
"My son was a reasonably good boxer in his day," she explained. "Watch a boxing match, and you'll notice that when one fighter throws a jab, a straight punch, usually with the left hand," Aunt El demonstrated as she spoke, jutting her left hand out straight, "the target will wait until the punch almost hits him, and then deflect it away with the slightest flick of the right wrist. And here's the amazing thing. The harder the punch, the less effort it takes to parry it. This is exactly what Lincoln did."
"So you see, it is about saying, 'You win,'" said Aunt El.
"But 'you win' doesn't have to mean 'I lose.' Quite the contrary. Letting the other person win is the beginning of one's own triumph."
Ben thought for a long moment, then slowly shook his head.
"I sort of get what you're saying, but I'm not convinced."
Claire laughed. Ben looked at her darkly. "Did I say something funny?"
"Uh-huh," she said. "You said Aunt El hasn't punched and beaten you yet."
Ben looked back helplessly at Aunt El.
"I said that?"
Aunt El was clearly amused.
"Convince means to overcome by argument," she explained. "It comes from the Latin word for conquer. You know the expression, 'a man convinced against his will'?"
"Is of the same opinion still," said Ben.
"Exactly. And is there really any other way to be convinced, conquered, overcome by argument, than against your will? In other words, you're right. Yielding does mean giving your power away. But the more you give away, the more you have."
Ben audibly groaned.
"I'm sorry, I just don't get that. That sounds like a complete contradiction. It still seems to me you give power away, people will walk all over you."
Aunt El looked at him disapprovingly and made a noise that sounded like, "Hm." The waiter came with their meals, and they began to eat.
"How is your fish?" asked Aunt El.
To Ben's taste, it was actually a little dry, but he just nodded and said, "Good."
"Really?" Aunt El's eyes narrowed. "I think it's off."
She turned toward the kitchen with an upraised forefinger and called out, "Scusi, Marco."
Ben was mortified. She was going to upbraid this poor waiter, who was already stretched to the breaking point, and send her food back?
The harried young waiter was instantly back at tableside.
"Signora?"
"Marco, who is cooking today?"
"Ah, Benedetto, signora."
"Wonderful." She set her napkin down and turned to face Marco directly.
"I wonder if you would tell Benedetto that the sauce is absolutely exquisite. He has outdone himself."
Marco beamed and nodded.
"Certo, signora."
"And," Aunt El lifted her hand with that same upraised index finger, "I don't really know a great deal about this particular style. Trata de gradella, is it?
Marco bowed in the affirmative. So I would definitely want to defer to Benedetto.
Marco leaned forward, eyes intently on Aunt Elle to make sure he caught her every exact word.
Si?
I'm wondering if it's possible to prepare it just a bit less well done. That is, a little more on the moist side. If it isn't, I'll completely understand. But if it is, I would so appreciate it.
Assolutamente, signora. Immediatamente.
Marco was already headed for the kitchen with their plates, when Aunt Elle added, Oh, and Marco?
Si?
Please tell Benedetto I adore the food here, and it gives me great pleasure to pay for it. I will be very cross if this dish is taken off my bill.
Marco smiled and bowed, then headed off to the kitchen.
Aunt Elle turned to Ben and said, So?
Ben looked at her, confused. So
what did you observe?
It took Ben a moment.
Oh, he said, the light gradually dawning. She had done all that on purpose. She was making a point.
You weren't listening, she said crossly.
No, Ben protested. I was.
Okay, hang on.
He thought for a second, then said, You started out by complimenting the sauce.
Everyone likes being acknowledged for doing a good job, she agreed.
And?
And you were obviously very polite,
he thought another moment, then added, You responded instead of reacting.
He paused and thought once more, and then said, Come to think of it, so did he.
Excellent observation, Aunt Elle practically beamed. If I had reacted, chances are good Marco would have done likewise. Whether you react or you respond, it tends to foster the same behavior in the other person. Expecting someone to be helpful doesn't change them, it changes you. And that, she added, is what changes them.
Also, instead of insisting on being right, I gave being right to the chef. I let our waiter know what would make me happy, but that if they couldn't accommodate my request exactly as I'd asked, I wouldn't make a problem out of it.
So you gave away all your power, observed Ben.
And did he walk all over me? Said Aunt Elle.
Ben held up his hands in a you win gesture.
Aunt Elle inclined her head. You're welcome.
Aunt Elle has a word for that, said Claire. And then she said in a stage whisper, as if pretending Aunt Elle couldn't hear her, Are we surprised?
Ben looked at Aunt Elle. She nodded. Yes, that would be an example of tact.
Tact? Ben had to stop himself from laughing out loud. He was starting to think that Aunt Elle was one of the bluntest people he'd ever met.
Aunt Elle must have caught something in his expression, because her eyes almost smiled.
Oh, I know, she said. I can be blunt.
But blunt isn't the same thing as tactless. Sometimes directness is called for, but thoughtlessness, never.
Tact is not the same thing as compromise. Tact, in fact, is the language of strength.
Ben thought about that for a moment.
I hate to be dense, he began, but how exactly is tact the language of strength?
To me, it seems like, I don't know,
the language of a weakling?
Aunt Elle gave another of her sphinx looks, an almost smile, so slight you'd miss it if you blinked.
Well, let's look at it. Tactful and tactile both come from the same Latin word, which is the word for touch. Having tact literally means being in touch with the other person. And when you treat someone with tact, it allows them to stay intact.
This goes back to the matter of influence, she added.
Ultimately, how effective you are, how influential you are, comes down to your intention. What are you focused on? Your benefit or theirs?
You've probably seen those talks, the ones where the speaker gets everyone all worked up to a fever pitch with an emotional story and then rallies them like drunken sports fans around some corporate mission.
Ben had to admit, he had heard that speech. He had given that speech.
But getting people to do what you want them to, whether or not they really want it for themselves, Aunt Elle continued, that's just manipulation.
Any second-rate television commercial can do that. Ben nearly winced. The day before, when Andel had asked him for a definition of influence, that was exactly what he had replied. Your ability to get people to do what you want them to. And he knew Aunt Elle well enough by now to know that she would have remembered that too. Now, she was saying, getting people to do what they truly want, that's an achievement. As a good friend of mine says, your influence is determined by how abundantly you place other people's interests first. That sounds like Pindar, commented Claire. Aunt Elle nodded and said, most influential person I've ever met. Wait, said Ben. You know Pindar? The chairman? He felt his pulse race. The man known simply as the chairman was something of a business legend. He was one of the most influential and successful businessmen and corporate consultants in the world. Of course, said Aunt Elle. That's how I met Claire. This was just too much. Ben pushed his chair back and threw his napkin down on the table in a gesture of exasperation. You know Pindar? He said to Claire. And you didn't tell me? Claire laughed. Not exactly. I mean, I've never actually met him in person. Let's say we have a mutual friend. Noting Ben's flabbergasted expression, she added, I'll tell you more about it some other time. Promise. I can't believe you two are saying this, said Ben. This is one of my biggest dreams. I've always wanted to meet the chairman. At that moment, Marco returned with their fresh entrees, cooked to perfection, and with a personal note of thanks from Benedetto. That night, Ben again took out the book Melanie had given him, set it on the little desk, and gazed at it. Ben's Manifesto. He sat, thinking again about Aunt Elle's question. What did he really have to offer them? He was feeling less and less certain that he knew the answer. Staring at the book's cover, he gestured at it like a stage magician and muttered, Presto Manifesto, and then sighed. It would be nice if a little volume's pages would magically reveal the answer. Unlikely, though, considering it was blank inside. What was it Augustine had said? How's our corporate raider doing this morning? Is that what he was? A corporate raider? He opened the book and looked at what he had written the night before on the first page. Ben's Keys to Legendary Leadership. Key number one, hold the vision. And now added another line to his list. Key number two, build your people. Turning to another fresh page, he began to write down some thoughts from his day. Build your people. Lead from the heart. Give people something good to live up to, something great, and they usually will. The more you yield, the more power you have. The substance of influence is pull, not push. Tact is the language of strength. He thought for another moment, then added at the bottom, and don't react, respond. Ben felt Mel's presence even before he heard her slippered footfalls. A moment later, he felt her hands on his shoulders. Hi, she said. Hi, he said back. What you doing? He held the book up so she could see. Peering over his shoulder, she read what he'd been writing. So, those your car keys you got there? She said. He put the book down, stood up, turned around, and kissed her. Nobody likes a wise guy, he said. She smiled, then hugged him, leaned in close, and whispered in his ear, Don't worry, we'll be okay.
Chapter 7. The Work. Thursday, Ben had arranged to spend his morning on the ground floor with Frank, VP of production. When he arrived at the reception desk on the dot of 9, the burly man with tree-trunk hands was there waiting for him. I appreciate your taking time to... But before Ben could finish the sentence, Frank had thrust an apron and a set of heavy gloves in his hands. Come on, show you around. Donning the gear as he walked, Ben followed Frank out to a row of loading docks in the back of the building, where several large trucks were unloading great stacks of lumber. "Excellent," said Ben companionably. "I love a little workout." Frank just grunted in reply. Ben suspected that Frank was not a man of many words. As it turned out, it was a bit more than the little workout Ben was expecting. 2.5 hours later, as they hand-trucked the last load of wood to its station on the big open-span expanse of the production floor, Ben was flat-out exhausted. Just as he was sitting down to rest, Frank beckoned him back to his feet. "You gotta see this," and set off at a solid stride, with Ben scurrying to catch up. A minute later, they were standing before a vast brick kiln lined with a sophisticated, computer-programmable sequence of steam jets. Ben was about to see how they cooked the wood. The process was fascinating, and Ben watched, entranced, for another 20 minutes before they set off for Frank's office, Ben doing his best not to limp visibly. On the way, Frank stopped to check in on a new employee who was busy hand-carving some intricate detail into the back of a large oak chair. "Custom job," commented Frank. "Traditional, all wood joinery, mortise and tenon, no screws or nails, all pegs and shims." Ben believed this was the longest sentence he had heard Frank speak all morning. Ever, in fact. "Show you something?" Frank said to the young man as he took the tool from his hand. He sat and began carving out a scroll design in long, continuous, curving motions as his student observed carefully. It was striking to see Frank's big, ham-like fist curled around the tiny instrument, performing this delicate operation. Oddly graceful, thought Ben, like a lumberjack doing needlepoint. "See?" said Frank, handing the tool back. The young man nodded. "Thanks, Frank." Frank grunted, "Good." And he and Ben were off again, walking the workroom floor. "Taught the kid's dad," Frank said as they walked. "He'll be okay." Frank gave Ben a sideways glance as they walked. "Said you like to work out. Seen our gym?" "Yes," Ben said. "It's a great idea. I'll bet you guys love having it right here in the building." "Yeah, I keep meaning to go," said Frank. "But who's got time? Anyway, I get my workout right here." Ben thought about that. "How long have you worked here, Frank?" Frank barked a laugh. "How long? Forever." They arrived at Frank's office, which was scarcely more than a desk and several chairs stuck in a 12-by-12 space at the far end of the production floor. "Let's sit," said Frank, an offer Ben accepted gratefully and immediately. "Coffee?" Ben accepted this offer eagerly, too. Frank took a bottle of water. "So you've seen the brothers?" Ben nodded. "Augustine yesterday, Alan Tuesday." "Right," Frank shook his head and coughed out another laugh. "Without vision, the people perish, blah, 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 I've heard it. Tell you what, they'll perish a whole lot faster without food." He took a long slug of water. "Don't get me wrong, I love those guys. I'd follow them over a cliff." Ben thought this was a telling choice of images. He was afraid Frank and the rest of the company might be on the verge of doing exactly that. "But, well, can I be Frank?" "Of course," Ben started to say when Frank exploded with a loud guffaw. "Sorry," Frank said, "dumb joke. Can I be Frank? What else could I be?" He let out one more guffaw, then grew instantly serious again. "Tell you what, Alan's got his head in the clouds half the time. And Augustine? Guy's got a heart of gold, which is great, but if you ask me, he can go a little overboard sometimes on the whole touchy-feely thing." "Frank?" One of Frank's crew poked his head in the door of Frank's office. He looked worried. "Yeah," Frank shot back. "Hang on." He turned back to Ben and said, "But I'll tell you one thing about those two nobody can argue. They know every inch of this business. They've paid their dues." Turning back to the man at the door, he said, "Shoot. That order Annie placed? Those construction guys with the Asian hardwood? We gotta get a truck out there today, but nobody can tell us how much the stuff weighs, so we don't know if a 2-ton rig will do or if we need a 10-ton, and they're not answering their phones." Frank's brow furrowed in thought. "The project budget won't let us send the bigger truck unless we absolutely need it," the man added. "But if the 2-ton turns out to be too small, we'll lose the whole order." Frank nodded and said, "Send the 2-ton. It'll work." "Right." The man disappeared from view. "How can you make a decision like that?" Ben wondered aloud, "when you don't have enough information to know whether you're right or not." "That's why they call it a decision," replied Frank. "If you had all the information, there'd be nothing to it. But sometimes you have to decide, even when you don't have all the information. Besides," he added, I'm pretty sure I'm right. Really? Ben was skeptical. How so? Frank looked at Ben. I know wood. Ben thought Frank's comment about making decisions left an opening big enough for a 20-ton truck to drive through, and the morning was nearly gone. Time to bring it home. Well, you guys sure have a big decision to make Monday. Frank nodded. And I want to make sure I give you as much good information as I can so you can make the best choice possible, for you and for your crew. Frank nodded again. Okay. In a few sentences, Ben laid out his case for how and why a marriage with the Martin Group would be the right move for Alan and Augustine. When he was finished, he looked at Frank. Frank took a few more swigs from his water bottle, nearly draining it, then looked at Ben. Ben, he said, let me be... Frank? Offered Ben. The big man's face relaxed a bit. Yeah, that too. I was going to say, let me be blunt. He pointed upwards at the floors above them. I told you I'd follow Alan and Augustine anywhere, and I would. These guys? He jerked a thumb in the direction of his crew out on the production floor. I don't know if they'd go over a cliff for the brothers, but I'll tell you what, they'd follow me anywhere. Why? One reason and one reason only. They respect me. Why? Because I know my pegs and shims. You can't run a tight operation unless your people trust you. Not the boardroom, not the market research, you. And they won't. Not unless you trust yourself. Frank gave himself a hearty smack of his fist against his substantial gut, right here. Ben hesitated. He recalled only too well that disastrous straw poll he had invited in the boardroom a few days earlier. But the question had to be asked. So, he said, what is your gut saying right now about the vote on Monday? Frank's expression was hard to read, but Ben was pretty sure he knew what it said. Why should I trust you? Frank stared at Ben for another 5 seconds, then drained his water bottle, tossed it across the room into a trash can on the other side of the little office, a perfect basket, and got up to walk Ben to the door. It hasn't decided yet.
Chapter 8. Being Muddy. No Aunt El? When Sal ushered him to the familiar corner table, Ben had found Claire sitting alone with a basket of breadsticks. She asked me to convey her regrets. She couldn't make it today. Ben felt a stab of disappointment. He'd been looking forward to more conversation with Aunt El. On the other hand, now he could talk more freely with Claire about his situation. And that was the whole point, he reminded himself. Intel, the inside scoop. Right? This was a golden opportunity. So, said Claire as Ben settled into his seat and picked out an appetizer from the menu, how's Mel doing? The three of them had first met and become friends in business school. 12 years ago, when Ben and Melanie went through a rough patch together. It was Claire who had helped pull them through. That was all in the past now, and their life was good, except that Mel had lost her job 6 months ago, and all her efforts at finding a new one had so far proven fruitless. Which meant it was all the more critical that Ben bring this merger to a successful conclusion. She's good, replied Ben. Great, actually. She loves being an at-home mom for a change, and Robbie sure isn't complaining any. He went on to brag about Robbie for a few minutes. At age 11, he was already an accomplished martial artist, had just passed his black belt test, with honors, Ben added, and was doing great in his schoolwork, too. But hey, Ben said, before we get into anything else, you promised me you'd tell me about Pindar. And Aunt El, who exactly is she, anyway? What kind of work did she do? Marco, the young waiter, came by to take their lunch order, and after he left, Claire addressed Ben's questions. That mutual friend I mentioned? It's Rachel, my boss. Before starting her own business, she used to work for Pindar and his wife at their mansion. That's how she met Aunt El. There was a whole circle of prominent business people who used to pass through Pindar's home. Aunt El was one of them. I think Pindar had consulted for her company or something. Anyway, Rachel and Aunt El became thick as thieves. Today, Aunt El is one of the biggest individual donors to Rachel's foundation. Ben's mind was reeling. So Aunt El wasn't just wealthy, she was stratospherically wealthy. What did Andel do? I mean, what was her business?
Claire smiled. She's a pretty private person, believe it or not. I'd have to have her tell you that. I'm sure she will, sometime. She did tell me a story once, though, about how Pindar got started. As a young man, Pindar sold business machines. This was in the days before personal computers. He'd held a number of odd jobs, none of them especially successful. But at one point, he made a conscious decision to excel. As a freshman rep for this small firm, he paid a visit on a promising new company that was about to go through the roof, although, of course, nobody knew this yet. Pindar was not the only one trying to land this particular account. In fact, as it turned out, there were four other salesmen from four other companies, including NCR, IBM, and a few other big names, all wooing the same client. They were all more skilled salespeople than I, the chairman told Andel. Every single one of them. They were all more experienced, and all far more accomplished. But, let me guess, said Ben, he got the account? He did, and when the company took off, so did Pindar's business. Soon he formed his own agency just to handle that account. More clients followed, and that was the first in what became a long line of successful ventures that built his fortune. So, why was he the one who got the account? Asked Ben. Claire laughed. That's exactly what I asked when I first heard the story. Well, said Andel, those others may have known more about selling, but he knew the machines, inside and out, backwards and forwards, every feature and capability, every jot and tittle, as he put it. So he was really into business machines, asked Ben. Not really. It wasn't about the machines. It was about the client. Pindar's gift is entrepreneurship, not electronics. And over the years, he built businesses in many different fields. But whatever he did, he always took the time to make sure he understood what it was his clients would need and exactly how his product or service would fulfill that need. When Pindar went in for that interview, there wasn't a question they asked that he couldn't answer. He was prepared. The client took this as a gesture of respect for them and their time, which was exactly what it was, and gave him the contract on the spot. And look what happened, murmured Ben. Claire nodded. Corporations started paying him huge sums for his advice, because they knew that he knew what he was talking about. He'd done the work. Marco brought their meals, which Claire greeted with enthusiasm. I'm starved, she said, as she took the first bite. The Trotta de Gradella it was, grilled trout, this time done to perfection. Andel says that's one of Pindar's success secrets that people often miss. Every field he's gone into, every business he's started, he's done at some point with his own hands, learning it nuts and bolts from the ground up. Pindar himself says his number one secret is giving. You heard Andel describe his law of influence. Your influence is determined by how abundantly you place other people's interests first. Andel says that's all true, but that there's more to it. He is a very giving person, and he also knows how to do the work. Rachel asked Pindar once, with all those high-rolling CEOs coming through his home, with his incredible reputation and all the huge sums of money flowing through his hands, how did he keep all that from going to his head? He laughed and said, yes, there's a lot of voltage flowing here, but it doesn't fry my circuits because I stay grounded. Grounded, repeated Ben. What do you suppose he meant by that? That's exactly what I asked Rachel, replied Claire. She thought for a moment, and then she told me another Pindar story. At one of the chairman's legendary parties, she met a wonderful older gentleman, a retired business leader named Lee Heron, who served for nearly two decades as CEO of O.M. Scott & Sons, now known as Scott's, the lawn and garden company. A few years after he took that position, the company's owners sold it to a big conglomerate. Many of the employees felt betrayed. It was up to Mr. Heron to make the transition work. And did he ever? Over the next 10 years, the company's sales nearly tripled,
Its net income increased by more than 500%. And he took Scotts from being a good company to being a great one. At Pindar's party that night, Claire explained, Heron had related an experience he had during World War II as a brand new second lieutenant in the Army Corps of Engineers. He had been out with troops in the field on a training mission. It had been a hard day, and when the mess line was ready, he went over to eat. But before he could be served, an old sergeant took him aside.
"Lieutenant," said the sergeant, "after your men have been fed, if there's any food left, then you will eat. And later, after all your troops have been bedded down, if there's a place for you to lie down, then you will sleep."
Wait. Ben couldn't stop himself from interrupting Claire's story. A sergeant correcting a lieutenant? Isn't that kind of, unusual? Claire laughed.
I'll say. That took chutzpah.
But Lee listened to him. "In that moment," he told the group at Pindar's, "that sergeant taught me a leadership lesson that has formed the core of my beliefs ever since." Claire laughed again, picturing the old sergeant putting the lieutenant in his place. "Rachel said Pindar just loved that story," she added, "and he went around repeating it to everyone he knew who hadn't already heard it. He just loved the fact that this lieutenant was willing to learn from his sergeant. And that, says Rachel, is what keeps Pindar grounded, as far as she's concerned. His humility. If you want to be hugely successful, she says, you have to stay hugely humble." Ben gave a short laugh. "Hugely humble. Now there's an oxymoron." Claire took another bite and looked at Ben thoughtfully. "Shall I tell you Aunt Elle's take on humility?"
"Please," said Ben.
It struck him as fascinating that even though Claire's mentor was not with them today, her presence somehow still seemed to command the conversation. "Aunt Elle says there are few terms more misunderstood in our culture. People often equate humility with a lack of confidence or self-esteem, or think that being humble means being weak. And of course," here Claire lifted her chin and peered along her nose at Ben, "they have it backwards. The more humble you are, the more personal power you have." Ben had to laugh. Claire did a very credible Aunt Elle impression. "She says the word humility shares a common root with humus. Being humble means being aware of your connection with the dust of the earth. The soil, she says, is the source of everything we have. Remember your muddy beginnings, and you can accomplish anything."
"That sounds like her," Ben commented.
He hoped that Aunt Elle's little saying might actually be true, because he certainly was feeling muddy right now about everything. "Here's another Elle-ism," continued Claire. "People who achieve great things that the world will never forget start out by accomplishing small things that the world will never see. Great leaders don't expect anyone else to do anything they haven't done themselves. They get dirt under their nails and mud on their boots." Ben wasn't quite sure if this was Claire quoting Aunt Elle now, or Claire simply being Claire. Given all the time the two had spent in each other's company, perhaps this was a distinction without a difference. "Abraham Lincoln knew law," Claire was saying. "He'd practiced it in freezing cold, bare-floored small-town courtrooms. So did Gandhi. They were both able to emancipate millions, but only because they knew the feel of the craft in their hands. George Washington knew the land. As a boy, Sam Walton milked the family cow and sold the surplus milk to neighbors. Bill Gates spent thousands of hours as a teenager programming computers. You know what Andrew Marden did? I mean, before he was the CEO of a vast conglomerate?"
"He was a merchant," Ben replied immediately, happy to have a question for which he knew that he knew the answer. "Sold dry goods, textiles, that kind of thing."
Claire laughed. "Before that, you should ask your boss sometime." She stopped talking for a bit to work on her meal. Ben picked at the edges of his. After a long minute of silence, Claire looked up and gave her old friend a level gaze. "So, Ben, how's it going?"
Ben realized that, without quite meaning to, he'd been avoiding talking about his situation at Allen and Augustine.
And wasn't that the very reason he was here with Claire in the first place? To try to gain the inside scoop? He looked at his plate, as he spoke.
Well, that merger I'm working on, it's with someone you know, someone you've worked with in the past.
Claire nodded.
Alan and Augustine.
He looked up sharply. You already knew?
I had a pretty good idea. So let me guess. You spent the morning today with Frank, walking the production floor?
Ben squinted at Claire. How did she know so much?
Yeah. Why? Does it show?
She gave a little laugh.
I thought you looked a little shell-shocked.
So you've already met with Augustine? And with Alan?
Ben nodded. And tomorrow, Karen.
Ah, said Claire. Well, she won't mince words.
Before Ben had a chance to ask what she meant by that, Claire reached over and poked him.
Hey, trivia. You know who made the very first Alan and Augustine chair?
All right. This one he knew, no question. I sure do, he replied. I sat in it myself on Tuesday. Nearly gave me a heart attack, too, when I realized I was sitting on a piece of company history. Alan made it.
Claire laughed again.
Nope. Alan had the idea. He designed the chair. But he didn't build it. That was Frank.
Frank?
Ben whistled. He recalled asking Frank how long he'd worked at the company. What had Frank said?
Forever.
The last time I was there, Claire continued, I remember thinking that big old brick building would fall down like an untied stack of kindling if Frank were down there on that first floor holding it up. They both chuckled for a moment at the picture that evoked, and then they fell silent again for a moment.
So, Claire repeated gently, how's it going?
Ben sighed. Claire, I think I'm in over my head. Mel and I really, really need this to happen. Bushnell obviously wants it badly, and I think my job is on the line. And heaven knows, Alan and Augustine certainly need it to happen, too. But I've met with three of the four levers of power there, and so far I'm 0-3.
He looked up at Claire.
You have any brilliant ideas? 'Cause I think I'm fresh out. Claire took the last bite of her grilled trout and pondered the question.
What does Mel say?
Ben sighed again. She says she believes in me.
Well, said Claire, she's pretty smart. Maybe you should follow her lead.
Ben took a distracted bite of a breadstick. Despite his workout that morning on Frank's loading dock, he wasn't very hungry.
Thanks, Yoda. So that's your brilliant idea?
Claire set her fork down and looked at him.
Ben, you don't have to be brilliant. The brilliant will take care of itself. You just need to do the work.
A sense of fatigue came over Ben, and he suddenly felt overwhelmed.
You can't worry about the outcome, Claire added quietly. Just do the work.
And not only because it needs doing, but also because that's the only way you'll generate real respect.
Ben nodded glumly.
Claire reached over and put her hand on his.
Ben, I'm not talking about gaining their respect. I'm talking about your respect. You want these people to trust you? Trust yourself.
Listen, humility doesn't mean self-abasement or devaluing your own worth. You can only be genuinely humble if you have enormous self-respect. That's something I learned from Pindar, even though I never met him, because it shines through the people he associates with, the people I have met. Self-respect is where every other kind of respect comes from. Respect from others is a reflection, not the source. It's not like, oh, if my boss respected me, if my son respected me, if the world respected me, that would be great. As if having respect from those other people would somehow generate your own respect for yourself. That'd be like asking the moon to make the sun shine. It doesn't work that way.
Ben was silent for a moment, then looked up at Claire and said, you know, you're pretty zen yourself.
Ha, said Claire.
Thanks, Grasshopper.
As he walked back up the street toward the parking garage to fetch his car, Ben shook his head in disbelief. He'd just had an entire lunchtime alone with Claire, his golden opportunity, and he'd squandered it talking about himself.
Way to go for that valuable intel, he muttered as he walked.
Keep your feet in the mud, stay connected to the humus.
That's what you got for inside scoop? Still, despite his own mumbled complaints, he felt himself turning over in his mind the things Claire had said. Somewhere inside, they had touched a chord. That night, Ben added one more key to his manifesto. Ben's Keys to Legendary Leadership. Key number one, hold the vision. Key number two, build your people. Key number three, do the work. On the next blank page, he carefully wrote down a few thoughts that had stayed in his mind from his morning at Allen and Augustine and his talk with Claire at lunch. Do the work. Lead from your gut. Know your pegs and shims. Stay hugely humble. Stay grounded. Get mud on your boots. And trust yourself.
Chapter 9, Birth and Death. Friday morning at 9:05, Ben emerged from the old brick building and stood on the sidewalk outside, struggling to decide what to do. When he had arrived at reception 5 minutes earlier to keep his appointment with Karen, the VP of Finance and Personnel, there was a message waiting for him, asking if he would meet her at the hospital. Ben's heart had leapt into his throat. The hospital? Had something terrible happened? Ben did not like hospitals. It had been more than a decade since he had set foot in one, and it would be fine with him if it were 10 more decades before he did so again. He honestly didn't know how he could go meet Karen there. But how could he not go? Monday's board meeting is on the line here, Ben, he muttered, standing on the sunlit sidewalk. Every vote counts, especially one as influential as Karen's. He couldn't afford to blow off this appointment. He might not get another chance. He headed up the street for the parking garage. He found the petite woman with the dark, intelligent eyes sitting on a bench just outside emergency, smoking a cigarette. Glad to see you're okay, he said. What happened? Amy, one of our customer service agents. I met her, said Ben, the enormously pregnant one. Karen nodded slowly. Enormously pregnant, that's Amy. She took a drag on her cigarette. She's gone into labor, way ahead of schedule. Complications. For the second time today, Ben's heart lurched. Is the baby okay? Karen stubbed out the cigarette and got to her feet. Actually, no. She grabbed a satchel from the ground by her feet and headed inside with Ben in tow, talking to him over her shoulder as they trod the halls. It started in the middle of the night. Both of them are in critical condition. The baby's in neonatal. Amy's isolated in critical care. They entered an elevator and Karen punched 3. Ben glanced at the elevator directory to see what was on the 3rd floor. After a moment, he asked, "So, why are we going up to oncology?" Another one of our employees, Phoebe in accounting, has a grandmother here. She's not doing well. Doesn't get many visitors. The elevator door opened and they walked down a series of hallways until they arrived at Phoebe in accounting's grandmother's room, where they stopped and waited. A moment later, a nurse emerged from the room and said, "They're doing a procedure now. She's sedated, but you can go in and sit in just a few minutes." Ben and Karen took their seats on a small bench in the hall. "Planning to be here long?" said Ben. He nodded at her satchel, which was overflowing with papers, files, and, Ben guessed, probably a small laptop. "Looks like you brought your whole office with you." Karen patted the satchel. "Yep, it could be a while." "Not to seem unfeeling," said Ben, "but if she's not even awake, and if Amy is in critical care and not taking visitors, then why are you here? I mean, there's nothing you can do." "No," Karen replied. "But it's not about doing, it's about being here." Ben thought about that. "Anyway," she said, "you're here, so let's talk. You're here to talk about the merger." "Right," said Ben. "You saw Allen and Augustine?" Ben nodded. "And yesterday, probably Frank?" Ben nodded again. Karen gave a little laugh. "The Three Musketeers. Is that what they call themselves?" "It's what I call them. Management, marketing, manufacturing. All for one and one for all. I guess that makes me D'Artagnan." She paused, and Ben suspected that if they were still outside, she would be taking another Betty Davis drag on a cigarette. Want some hospital coffee? Sure, said Ben. They got up and walked slowly down the hall as they talked. They're good guys, the Three Musketeers, Karen said, and they all see important aspects of the business. Aspects. But I sign every check. I know every name, every face. When business is down, I feel the impact it has on every single employee. Arriving at the little alcove that served as a coffee station, Karen poured out two cups. Touch of half and half, one sugar, said Ben in answer to Karen's querying look. She took hers black. Finance and personnel, Ben mused. That's kind of a funny combination. He took a sip of coffee. It was very likely the worst coffee he'd ever tasted. Not really, said Karen. Money is more than numbers on a ledger. Money is where it all gets real. Money is an organization's lifeblood. Monday you said you were here to help the bleeding stop. I deal with the bleeding every hour of every day. She looked down into her coffee cup as if the answers to life's mysteries might be read there. Maybe, she mused, a transfusion from your company is exactly what we need to survive. Ben quickly took another awful sip in an effort to mask any hint of reaction on his face. But inside, he was feeling a surge of jubilation. That sure sounded like a yes vote to him. And, she continued, maybe it's not. Maybe we can survive the blood loss on our own. Ben's jubilation faded. Look, Karen continued, the economy's bad right now. 10 years ago it was great. 10 years from now, who knows? She tasted her coffee, made a face, then took another sip. My point, economies rise and fall. Circumstances change. We bleed. We heal. We grow. Sometimes we end up in critical care. We can't control any of it, not really. What we can control is who we are. And bottom line, that's the only thing that counts. Ben had no idea what to say, so he forced himself to have another slug of coffee. Karen watched him, and then surprised him with an impish grin. It's really deadly, isn't it? Ben laughed, truly. Karen looked down into her coffee cup again, then back up at Ben. Why are you here, Ben? I mean, I know it's your job, but why are you here, really? Wow, said Ben, and I thought Frank was direct. He expected her to laugh, but she didn't, so he considered her question. Bottom line, he said, I want to see Alan and Augustine recapture its former glory. Karen looked at him for a moment, then she said, Do you believe in this company, Ben? Absolutely, he said without hesitation. Karen looked faintly amused. That's a strong word. So your belief in our company is absolute? Ben hesitated, and Karen continued. Let me ask you this. Would you lay down your life for this company? Now Ben was taken aback. Whoa, he began, but Karen cut him off. Don't worry. I don't think it'll exactly come to that. Again, that faint smile. But here's my point. People use words awfully casually. They say, I'd give anything to, or I'll bet anything that. Really? Anything? She shook her head and took another swig of the deadly coffee. Ben had the idea that she would have been right at home throwing back a slug of rot-gut rye at a stand-up bar in the Wild West. As the sheriff. Well, she said, you'll never hear me say, I would give my life for this company, or I would give my life for these people. She looked at him. You know why you'll never hear me say that? Ben did not know. Because of the word would. Said Karen. It's not I would give my life for these people. I do give my life for them. Every day. And they give it too. That's why I'm here today. That's what we do. That's who we are. She drained the paper coffee cup, crushed it, and tossed it in the trash. I honestly have no idea if this merger is a good idea, a great idea, or a terrible idea. Here's what I do know. You want my vote? You want me to encourage others to trust you with their vote? Her cell phone rang, and she glanced at the number as she kept talking. People will only trust someone when they know where he stands. Where do you stand, Ben? And what do you stand for? Before Ben could think about how to answer that, she flipped open the phone and spoke into it. Hang on. Then, to Ben, I have to take this outside, maybe a while. She left Ben there. A moment later, another nurse emerged from the patient's room and called softly down the hall to Ben. You can go in now. Before he could reply, she walked down the hall the other way and disappeared around a corner, leaving Ben alone outside the patient's room. Ben felt torn. Should he stay and wait for Karen? Or just leave? He didn't